My name is Peter Nash, and this is the second of five sessions on biblical images of shalom. And today, I intend to talk about the biblical basis for shalom. Yesterday, we took a quick look at what shalom is, and just in a few minutes, I'd like to remind those of you who were here and catch up those of you who are here for the first time on what we had to say about that. There are at least two ways to talk about shalom. And in many ways it depends on how much authority one has been given or has seized over the environment, or how little power one has. One without any authority or power over the environment looks to shalom for to create or restore God's justice and evening out of the world so that everyone has enough and everything has enough, so that we nothing is in need, and that includes human beings, animals, plants, the very ground we walk on itself. And depending on how desperate one is for food, one becomes more concerned for other parts of the environment. Charity in most cases begins not only at home but right here in the belly. And that shows up in the biblical text, and we looked at several passages yesterday that indicated that. The people of oppression have that sort of a view of shalom. Level things out, make sure that I get enough and everyone around me gets enough, because we know that there's enough to go around. At the other end of the spectrum, or the continuum, is the view of those with authority and power to distribute, to make sure that people get enough, that the plants get enough, that the earth is cared for in its fullness. And when they do their job, and when no one in the system gets corrupted, then that happens reasonably well, with given room for human error. Tanker pilots that aren't quite where they're supposed to be in the process of moving oil around. But basically, they do their job well. But what happens is that humans get involved in this process, and there's always, from the beginning of time, some graft along the way. The Code of Hammurabi, which we tend to think of as the first law code, but it has a couple of predecessors. But that was 1800 BC. There are some from, there's at least one from 2500 BC, a law code. And the first thing they talk about is making sure that there's justice. The gods ordained them as kings to make sure that there was justice for widows and orphans. So there has always been an awareness on the part of that royalty and through history that there's an obligation, and they've interpreted it as a divine obligation to provide for everyone. Of course, if you have the power, you tend to collect the power. And we see that even in the palace of King David and his children. Yesterday, John gave us the word harmony, a living at peace, at stasis with the environment, and with one another. And it's based on our relationship with the Creator. Seems that there was one other thing I wanted to say, but since it's not written down in front of me, it has escaped me. The basis, as I just said, for this shalom, this well-being, this health, this wholeness, is our relationship with God and God's relationship with us. And the way that we best know that relationship, as it's presented in the scriptures of the Hebrew Bible, is through this word covenant. Below it you'll see the Hebrew scribbling for it and the transliteration of that word, berith. We're not quite sure where this word comes from. In many cases, we know we have enough examples of the word that we can tell you exactly what we think is exactly the original meaning of the word. This may be the bar that locks the door. There's a word that looks like it that means the iron or bronze bar that locks the door. It may mean a link or part of a chain that which holds us in a particular relationship. At any rate, what it does mean is a covenant. And for people who don't go to church every Sunday, and even many of us who do, covenant isn't a particularly useful word. So I'm going to suggest today that you think of this as a contract or a treaty. Those are the two places that this word tends to show up in the English language today when our government or English-speaking governments write treaties. The word covenant often appears in them, and when lawyers write contracts, covenant often appears in many types of contracts. So what is a contract? When you think of a contract, what are the what does it make? What does it take to make a contract?
Between two people or two parties?
Two people or two parties, and you have to have some sort of an agreement. Yes?
In addition to the agreement, the contract usually defines what each party will do.
Okay, there's a definition or stipulations of what each party is obligated to do. Anything else? Sometimes there's some background that sets the parameters for those stipulations, why we're in this agreement, what the situation is, when this agreement will end, other than breaking the stipulations of the contract.
Can be revocable or irrevocable.
Can be revocable or irrevocable.
Consequences to not following the contract.
Consequences for not following the contract. Usually in these cases it's war or loss of some right that's granted within the contract. No, you no longer have. If you don't keep your dog on your side of the fence, then you'll no longer be able to use my side of the fence because I don't like to clean up after your dog. Basically, contracts have been contracts since they've been written down, with a slight exception. There are two basic kinds of contracts. One between equals, which is called, in biblical studies, is called a parity contract, because the two parties have parity. Neither one can force the other into the relationship. And then we have suzerain contracts, or vassal, suzerain covenants, or vassal covenants, where one is clearly superior in strength and ability to enforce the contract. One analogy that we can draw, it's easy to draw right now, is the Soviet Union and its client states of the Warsaw Pact. As that contract, that covenant tends to break up. What the Soviet Union promised to do was to stabilize their economies after the war, to protect them from Western aggression, and we did the same in the United States in the NATO alliance, that we stabilized the economies, rebuilt a great deal through aid, and developed a system whereby they would be protected if there were Eastern aggression. And in return, we got some very sweet deals. I know that I one summer went to Germany at almost no cost to myself, because the German government owed us so much money. One of the things that they did was take on American students through public law monies. One of the ways that they, one of the benefits to the suzerain in this case, the United States. The treaties of and covenants of the Old Testament are very similar. They're of two types. They're either suzerain, or vassal treaties, or parity treaties. And let's take a look at some of them today. I'm you're going to do this. I want you to do this together and then come back and report. So I'm going to divide you arbitrarily into four groups and ask you to arrange yourselves as comfortably as you can to read these aloud together or read them silently and then talk about it. And then we'll report back to one another in about 10 minutes, okay? If I'm going to draw a line straight back here to Peter. And Peter, if you go with this group on my left. And then if we go from here over to, your name is?
Margie.
Margie. You would go with this group here. And your name in the plaid shirt?
Jerry.
Jerry. Over here to, let's say over to the pole. Are we splitting up fast friends here? And this would be the fourth group. And this group over on my far left would take Genesis 9, and then 9, 8 through 17. If the second group would read Genesis 15, the third group would read Genesis 20, and the fourth group would read 2 Samuel 7, 1 through 14. Now these are all suzerain treaties. These aren't parity treaties. We'll look at parity treaties in just a minute. So if you look at those, the question I'd like you to ask yourself as you look at these are these treaties or covenants inclusive or exclusive? And if they're exclusive, whom do they include and exclude? Who's in and who's out? Finish up the thoughts that you're on and just turn around and get as comfortable as you can, because I'm going to ask you to use these groups again a little later. And let's have the bold ones among you report back. The group on my left is all wet. Someone want to report back which story you had and what your conversation, how your conversation went?
Ours is with the covenant with Noah after the flood, and how God promises not to use waters to destroy the world again, and using the sign of a bow in the heavens to represent that covenant.
Okay.
It seemed to be the kind of contract that came directly from God, and no real response required on the part of humankind.
Mm-hmm. Inclusive, exclusive.
We had a little debate about that. inclusive, in the sense it says all flesh, and Noah and descendants.
Mm-hmm.
But then we were asking about, does that include plant life? I mean, is that all destroyed then? How do we understand the earth as almost a living organism? Does that put humankind and even creatures in a different place than the organism of the earth?
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, though, because it's inclusive. It says, never will I cut off all flesh again. But in a way, it could be exclusive of certain portions of the flesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's an out there. We usually perceive an out there that there's with the all being there, that there you can get selective. God could get selective, and that the fact that it's water, some people interpret that as an out. I want to say a word about that. In the mind of the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians, the two big civilizations of the period, that was the threat. The way cities were wiped out was when the rivers got out of control and they were just washed away. When the Nile flooded, if you weren't prepared for it, you were gone. And when the Tigris and the Euphrates occasionally went wild, then a city could just disappear in a matter of minutes. So that, I think this story reflects their idea of a universal destruction. Because as far as they were concerned, their village and the few villages around them was the whole world. They weren't cursed with shortwave radios and nightly news. So it's, in terms of people, it's everybody, because it's everybody that's left. Maybe, because we've got that, I will not destroy all flesh. But there's a sign for everyone that it's my intent to give life. And a sign that if I'm right about the rivers being the source of this this story, a sign that nature will be reliable. Never again will these chaotic waters, again, these are the chaotic waters of creation that they have to deal with in the ancient world. When we started things, there were waters that were out of control. And when those waters break in, again, chaos is there. And that's what needs to be controlled and needs to be prevented. So never again will that those chaotic waters, those primeval waters from Genesis 1, come in and make everything unlivable, is the promise of nature is reliable now. So we have, at least as far as humans are concerned, a universal covenant here. And I think, I overheard part of your conversation, I think they just did think of themselves, humans and animals, things that could move around as sort of a different order from the plants, with a respect for them, but not, they survived these floods that they knew about.
In my translation, I'm just wondering about the Hebrew, the I have in verse 14, between me and the earth, and then verse 17, between myself and every living thing. Mm-hmm. And then other times, creature is used, but sometimes it just says earth and living thing. So I'm just wondering. Sounds a little more inclusive.
Yeah, let me just... between myself and between and the earth.
And then 17 as well.
And 17.
Every living thing.
This is the same covenant which established between myself and between all flesh.
All flesh.
Mm-hmm. All flesh which is upon the earth. So. Okay, how about this second group? You got another biggie. Actually, these are the four biggies in the life of Israel. Any brave soul there that will take the chance of reporting the conversation?
Ours is the covenant of God with Abraham. To give him a certain amount of land to his descendants. And I think we decided it was pretty exclusive. It was just for his family and his descendants that he gave his land.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was it for all of his descendants?
I would say yes.
Doesn't Abraham ever? Yeah, really.
Well, we must be wrong.
Which county am I thinking of here? Doesn't Sarah give Abraham her hand servant, her Egyptian?
Well, yeah, but that's after this. That's in later verse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I actually argue it's similarly to you, but. The covenant is perceived to be by Jews at least, and the church has traditionally taken this view that the covenant, the blessing comes through Isaac, and Ishmael does receive a blessing, but it's a different blessing.
Mm-hmm. It does say that, you know, through your son, not your slave's offspring.
So it is pretty narrowly defined. It's a small circle. one man, one woman, and their offspring are the beneficiaries here. Is there a response required? Looks like a great meal, though, doesn't it? In your passage, you get all this preparation of food, because one of the things that you do when you make a covenant in the ancient Near East is to cook a big feast and sort of seal the contract over the table. So we've got one very universal covenant, followed by one that is pretty particular.
One of the things that you didn't really resolve is how it was that Abraham qualified before God to get this covenant. Why did God choose Abraham? That this chapter doesn't really talk about that, but can you shed some light on that?
I think he qualified the same way that I qualified for baptism. I mean, this is an old guy in Ur of the Chaldeans who, for no apparent reason, catches a vision, is given a vision and a call, and he responds to it. I don't read in the text any particular qualifications, anything that would make him more attuned.
Another part of that question is, how is it that God communicates with Abraham? How does this differ from the way God communicates with us today?
I think the person after me is going to do that Bible study in 2 weeks. or the pastor for the community of Verlon Brown or Carol Tomer will answer that, right, Verlon? That's
in two weeks.
That's a problem with every person in Scripture. Why is it that God talks seemingly so directly to these people and he doesn't talk to me that way? Why do I have to kind of stumble around? But if you look at the next big character, Isaac gets a short little piece so we can get to Jacob, and Jacob, whose name is then changed to Israel. And he really kind of stumbles around trying to find the will of God. And this is the man for whom the nation is named. He sometimes looks like a bumbler in trying to find the will of God. So we have both models, at least.
Would we say then that it could be exclusive or inclusive, because Abraham his faith was strong enough to receive what Christ was telling him, or would we...
Let me back you up a step, okay. Because Christ isn't in our text today.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Would we say then that, you know, because Abraham was open to that it would, well, from Abraham's standpoint, it would be inclusive, but perhaps for us it would be exclusive because it was only Abraham. But then as a Christian, for us, you know, we have a responsibility to be open to what, you know, God is telling us through our faith, and that would, if you're open to that, it would be inclusive, because in through the text, God is including all of us.
Our tradition interprets it that way, that we have, as the church, been grafted onto that vine, Israel. Mm-hmm. And there have been some modifications made, so this is the luxuriant vine, the one that's grafted, as often the case with hybrids. But it is, this covenant is for one man and one woman and their families, and the children of Israel, the descendants of Abraham through Isaac and then Jacob, took that very seriously, that this was their covenant. And that is one of the problems that we see later on, is that they began to take it as a right and as something that they earned. When we read the prophets as we approach the exile and during the exile, that was the big mistake, to take it as some, that Abraham was in some way qualified for this grace of a covenant with God. No, it was pure, in Lutheran terms, pure grace, freely given. And we are the beneficiaries of that. As this covenant opens up, I've drawn this. This is left over from the last time, but I don't have to get up and draw it again. The covenant is can be conceived of as the covenants can be conceived of as concentric circles. When we get to act, when we get to these specific covenants with individuals, where it's made with this one family, and then it opens up some, and it opens up some more, until finally, in the new covenant, it's open to all, again, to all creation, in the way it was open to all creation with Noah. Bless you. Initially, it's very narrow. Even though included in that passage, I think included in the passage that I gave you, are the words that you will be by you, all nations will bless themselves, or all nations will be blessed by you. So that there's an understanding early, even in the early going, that this is not something that belongs to Abraham, but it's for the benefit of all creation. We just happen to get turned in on ourselves. Talk about biggies. How about this one? Exodus 20. Is that for some or many? Is that for some or for everybody?
It's for the Israelites.
For the Israelites?
It's God's promises to him, to them, through Moses.
Okay. The part that I read didn't have many promises, though, did it?
Well, no, I didn't mean promises, excuse me. It's demands, okay. Commandments. You will. All
right.
If you will do this, I have taken you out of Egypt, and now you will live according to my instructions.
So we get set up with that first verse tells you, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the house of bond, out of the house, land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me in the second verse. So that's where we set up.
We found it interesting too that they felt they needed an intercessory there. They didn't want to speak directly.
Right. I think if God were to appear on, what's the name of this mountain, Scott?
Well, we've got buckskin and copper and dumbbell. How about
that? Is the Sinai translated as dumbbell? Let's take copper. If God were to appear in a storm on Copper Mountain, I think I would ask God to go up. And I would stay down here, and whatever he said when he came back, I would probably do, which is the response in the part that you didn't read. Whatever you say, whatever he tells you, Moses, we will do. So there is, in this case, not in the part that you read, but there is, the stipulations are given. This is what I expect of you because of what I've already done and what I will do to keep you in this relationship, to protect you. And they say, yes, sir, whatever you say, we will do. So, but here, I heard someone say early on that the Egyptians were certainly excluded. Anyone else that comes to mind that's excluded from this?
Included are all the people mentioned in you do not covet what belongs to your neighbor. So all your neighbors are included, and also the asses and the cattle are included.
Okay. Do you have an idea, anybody have an idea of who the neighbor is in this context?
Part of the tribe.
Part of the nation.
Or one of the nation. One of the tribes.
Yeah,
so the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Perizzites are not included.
Yeah. Not only do you not covet their stuff, you destroy it when you take their land. It goes both ways. Most cases, it's destroyed. In some cases, there are stipulations for keeping the pure part of it for sacrifice. But that's a sacrifice to God. It's not something that you take. You just wipe them right off of the face of the earth. And interesting that language comes back to haunt us in the 20th century in reverse. Drive them into the sea. Anything else that was interesting about those 10 words? Questions?
Yeah,
I
was
going to
ask,
question? And how about this, the last of the big four, so to speak, of the OT, of the Old Testament?
This covenant was with basically the house of Israel, specifically a ruling line, starting with the judges and then coming to David, and the inference then continues to King David Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much of a suzerain type treaty, because David has a lot going for him and decides, well, I'm going to do something for God now, and God pulls him right up short and says, you don't have to do anything for me, I'm doing everything for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite exclusive. It includes the whole nation of Israel and all of the previous things that might pertain to them, but it is specific then through a ruling line at this point.
Mm-hmm. So the covenant that in which we're trying to create shalom in the Old Testament, in which we're trying to maintain this balance, is at this point limited to the people of Israel. That's where it stands. So the circle has gone from family to what is conceived of now as family, because what we actually see, if we go back and look at a couple of points in the story, is that other people have come into this have married into this family, and some people have converted into this family. When it was purely a genealogical deal, we have the story of Judah and Tamar. The descendants of Judah, the big tribe, the tribe from which David came, and the tribe from which Jesus subsequently came, has as their foremother a woman, a Canaanite woman, who, because Judah was not faithful to the laws of Israel, had to sit at the side of the road and pretend she was a harlot in order to have relations with the head of the family to produce the offspring that it was her right and obligation to produce for her deceased husband. So in David's genealogy and in Jesus' genealogy as it's presented, as David's genealogy is presented in Jesus' genealogy, Tamar is one of the two women mentioned. And the other woman mentioned is a foreigner as well. David's great-grandmother, Ruth, who was a Moabite. So these two women marry into the covenantal relationship. And during the period of the judges, we hear about a couple of nations who, in order to avoid being wiped out, make a covenant with Joshua and are able to then convert into the covenantal relationship. So we've got this small concentric circle getting a little bit bigger, and including some more after it, as we've seen with the first one that we've mentioned. We had a big circle to begin with, and it got very narrow, very specific, and then begins to move back out. Let's look real. Look at a couple of parity treaties. If we look at 1 Samuel 18, see one of the first recorded blood brothers.
Reference again.
1 Samuel 18, verse 1 and following. Now it came about, when he had finished speaking to Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day and did not return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And Jonathan stripped himself of his robe, of the robe that was on him, and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over the men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So the king's son and the king's servant become fast friends, and they make a covenant, and then the sign of this covenant is the giving of the robe and the giving of the armor. That's just an example of a parity treaty, a parity covenant between two friends. A more dramatic example, and one that looks more like a contract, is in Genesis 31, 43 through 55. And the background of this story is that Jacob has finally got fed up with the trickery of his father-in-law, Laban. Remember, Jacob worked for 7 years for Rachel and wound up married to Leah. Worked for another 7 years and was married to Rachel, and then couldn't get his share. I mean, Laban's flocks prospered and prospered and prospered under Jacob's leadership, and Laban would not let him have his property, would not give him his due, and so he sneaks off in the middle of the night and takes his family with him, his two wives and their servants and all the children that have been born so far, and one of the daughters takes the family gods with them, whatever that means. I'll leave you to figure that out in 3 weeks after Verlan explains to you why Abraham got the direct word and we don't. Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, the children are my children, the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have born? So come now, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinmen, "Gather stones," so they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. So there's your covenantal meal that we have in the church reflected as the Eucharist. Now Laban called it Jegashar Hadutha, which is an Aramaic word, which means pile of stones. Jacob called it Galid. And Laban said, "As this heap is a witness between you and me this day, therefore it was named Galid." And Mitzpah, for he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another." You often hear this as a blessing. If you read the context carefully, you'll notice that this is actually a curse, because they've already cheated each other once apiece, and now they're saying, "May the Lord watch between us when we're absent from one another." And then made clear by what follows, "If you mistreat my daughters or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." That's Laban's side of it. "I don't want my daughters mistreated. I don't want my daughters, my grandsons disinherited by this, by other offspring." That's the part of the covenant that he's really interested in. That's his side of it. So that's an example of a parity covenant between equals. I was going to have you turn back in the same groups and discuss this, but I'm going to ask you just for a minute to think about what it means to have more than one covenant and the ways that you are in covenant with other people. Do you have parity treaties? And do you have suzerain treaties? Where is it that you have the authority to make decisions, to make things equal and livable and harmonious? And where is it that someone has those decisions over your life? So just take a minute to think about that. What kinds of covenants do you have in your life? Contracts at work, family obligations, marriage covenants. Where are you promised? Religious, obviously religious covenants through baptism. Agreements that you make with others through handshakes.
suzerainty treaty. It's hard to think of one except maybe the government protecting my place in life in this country. I don't have much choice in that.
You have much choice in that one?
I pay taxes.
How about where you have authority? Do you have children? Mm-hmm. And do you have any employees, any people that you supervise? The next question is then, where do those covenants come into conflict with one another? Does it ever occur that what you have promised to one, or one has insisted that you promise to them, means that you can't keep your covenant with someone else?
Ideally, if we all led orderly lives, each new covenant would be predicated on all the other ones, and so you would try and avoid those kind of...
Yeah, if we all led orderly lives.
I think a classic conflict would be, usually the treaty would be more of your job, your employee, parent, and children, and you have a covenant with your employer, and then you have more of a parity with your family, and it goes off and down, and...
Mm-hmm. In a covenant, there's negotiation, and so sometimes in order to achieve the end, you have to make a compromise. And the compromise could end up very easily in an opportunity or perhaps a reason to break a previous covenant.
That's a good point. Usually, when we think of contracts, there's usually some negotiation, but the covenant that we've seen, and in many cases covenants with employers, there's no room for negotiation. And that leads to the what's going to have to be the final point that I wanted to make today, is that Israel was required to have but one covenant. Because a covenant with any covenant they would enter into with anyone else, the king of Assyria, the king of Babylon, the king of Egypt, a Hittite king, a Canaanite king, a Philistine king, I'm pointing geographically here. We have a map, a three-dimensional map right here. Would mean that they would be looking to someone else for protection. The protection that God promised them, they would be looking for someone else to give to them. And God couldn't have it that way. God had to have whole attention, whole devotion, whole tribute, in order to ensure that they would respond to God's commands, God's requirements, so that there would be shalom within their borders, and thereby make it possible for them to leak out, so to speak, of that concentric circle into the next concentric circle, so that they could be a leaven, to use a New Testament term, in the world. And that's where the prophets said that they got into trouble, when they started to look, aside from their religious problems, the religious problems were looking to other gods to do those things, to make the rain for the crops. The big problem with Baal worship, the agricultural deity of the Canaanites, and the international treaties with Egypt and with Assyria and Babylon, the two powers in Mesopotamia. They were then spreading out their loyalty and thereby dissipating the covenant, breaking the covenant with Yahweh. Let me read just one more piece. This is from Leviticus 18. And the point of this is that the obligation to do right within the covenant is within the family. It starts at home and then moves out, which is problematic for many of us. But fortunately for us, we don't have to live our lives out of the Old Testament. You just have to listen to it on these few mornings for me. But if you understand this, then what Jesus does makes a whole lot more sense and is a whole lot more freeing. And we'll talk about some of that, the individual freedoms that come already in the Old Testament and are really blown up in the New Testament. This is Leviticus 18, beginning with verse 9. Again, looking for shalom, looking for a balance within the community. Now when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of the field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of the harvest. Nor shall you glean your vineyards, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave it for the needy and for the stranger. I am the Lord. So the circle already gets opened up a little bit there, the stranger, the one who's passing through and needs something to eat. Should be hospitable, but this is one way of building in hospitality. You shall not steal or deal falsely, nor lie. In the Decalogue, it just says you shouldn't do it. Leviticus makes it very clear who we're talking about here. This is addressed to the Israelites. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. And you shall not swear falsely by my name, so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night long until morning. You shall not curse a deaf man, nor place a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall revere your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Again, your neighbor. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. We still have a fairly small area, a small little globe that we want to maintain the peace within. And that's the vision of a limited vision of shalom as it's interpreted in a time when the people are struggling to get over, so to speak. They've lost track of this universal covenant with Noah. They've lost track of the universal element of the covenant with Abraham, and what they're doing is trying to make it level within the nation. They have not. This passage sort of squelches the universal elements of shalom. Although we have to remember that all of this stuff gets included. Never in the life of Israel was the voice of the universal squelched. It was always there, it just always wasn't at the forefront. Yes?
Are you suggesting that you have to be exclusive before you can be inclusive, that that has to be well and healthy, and then only be inclusive?
I'm suggesting that the way they understood it, they were only obligated to work at home, within the nation, within the family, then within the clan, the tribe, and the nation. That was the extent, that was their interpretation of where the covenant required them. That was, if they could keep it there, then that was enough.